You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. And joining us on Perspectives today is Domingo Martinez. Domingo is the author of the book, The Heart is a Drunken Compass, a memoir. And he is a National Book Award finalist and New York Times bestselling author of The Boy Kings of Texas. Domingo, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, a lot of people who listen to our show want to know exactly, how did you get started in writing? Was this something that you did as a child? And if people are familiar with your first book, The Boy Kings of Texas, they know that it was a different upbringing that you had, and we can talk about this in just a minute.
It wasn't really triggered until I was about in middle school, when I was around 14 or 15 years old. Prior to that, it was more just observation and just watching and realizing that I had a very, very different point of view. My family, the people around me. But I kept that quiet until, like I said, actually, when I hit high school, I accidentally wandered into a journalism class. And I realized I just had this really natural knack for writing, for being able to put what was in my mind down on paper. Almost seamlessly. And by the time I graduated, it didn't even take that long. It was like the next year I was in charge of the paper and I was in charge of production and everything. And I saw just how powerful the gift of writing actually is, and how it like leaked out into like every other class that I was doing, and just how useful it was kind of at the world at large. And eventually it just became sort of, like I said, a compulsion. It's just something that I did. When I became an adult and pursued graphic design, I always wanted to write as my main career, but I never had the opportunity, the confidence. I did have the skill, I just didn't have the credentials. And so it took me like 20 years to write my first book.
We are visiting with Domingo Martinez. He is a New York Times bestselling author of The Boy Kings of Texas. And his latest novel is actually a book. It's a memoir. My Heart is a Drunken Compass. Domingo, you mentioned about growing up and you had a different perspective, different point of view. And I want to take us back to The Boy Kings of Texas. If you can, for the benefit of our listeners who may have not read that book yet, tell us a little bit about that and how that perhaps affected your writing or the ability not to be able to write because you get peer pressure, your friends want you to do something else, and they say, "Nah, you can't do that. That's not for us," and stuff like that.
Well, The Boy Kings of Texas was written over the course of actually, it didn't really take shape until about like five to six, seven years ago, when at that point I had amassed enough actual like content to realize that I was onto something, that I had a story, that I had a narrative through line, that I was sitting on something potentially very, very useful and bigger. Because for the most part, I would write like a chapter or a story or an image or a memory or something, and then, like sometimes, just out of nowhere, it was because I was trying to, woo a chick over email. "Hey, baby, you don't know how tough I had it," type of thing. And because, obviously it never worked. But then I would save those emails and put them away. That's the thing, is I could never really pin down when it coalesced. And I realized, holy cow, I actually, have something here. But the thing about that book was it was all memories. It was all about growing up in Texas, in South Texas in particular, in Brownsville, and straddling those two worlds. And it was when I had that sort of clarity that I realized that, wow, not everybody here in Seattle actually slaughtered cows for Christmas or, were forced to make tamales by their grandmother for, 2 days running. not everybody here had a father who, shot, a pack of dogs just to save his honor. Not everyone here grew up like, wow, why do people make such a big deal about, the 4th of July? Because we were always working in the fields at the time. And so I got to really sort of sense the difference between, what I was, my growing up and what other people had experienced. And the fact that they were actually really keenly interested and not in a sort of prejudicial sort of like, condescending, you poor thing. They were like, no, tell us more about this, the grape fields. Tell us more about smuggling marijuana with your dad to make ends meet when he was broke, things like that. And those are the stories that I write about where things had gone so hard. This is what we do when you live in the margins and you're poor and you're struggling to survive. And that's kind of how the genesis of The Boy Kings of Texas sort of came along. And the thing was that, especially with memoir, you never really have a stopgap. You never have a stopping point because you just want to keep writing. That's precisely what happened with the first book was that, well, I'm not finished, I got this other really horrible story to tell you. And my editor was like, let's just stop at page 590, click, And so that's where I needed to pick up the last part, which is this next book, My Heart is a Drunken Compass, and sort of bracket off the end of Boy Kings. And the way I'm describing this next book is, if Boy Kings of Texas was all about like family mythologies, this book that I'm putting out now is about the consequences. It's about all the impact and the consequences of, you know, bad choices, bad decisions, bad feelings, and some good ones too. But for the most part, it's just like, it's a good companion piece, but it also stands alone. My Heart is a Drunken Compass, the book that I have out now.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you if people needed to read Boy Kings of Texas first. And I guess you would prefer that they would do that. And some people like to do that because they want to do anything in chronological order.
Right.
But the fact that it stands alone is good. We are speaking with award-winning author Domingo Martinez. Domingo is the New York Times bestselling author of The Boy Kings of Texas, which was a finalist for the National Book Award in 2012, a gold medal winner of the Independent Publisher Book Award, a 2013 Pushcart Prize nominee, and has been optioned by HBO for an original series. Martinez's work has appeared in Epiphany, a literary journal, Huizache, literary magazine, New Republic, Texas Monthly, and Savior Magazine, and he is a regular contributor to This American Life. He has appeared on NPR's All Things Considered and The Diane Rehm Show, and was the recipient of the Bernard Devoto Fellowship in Nonfiction at the Breadloaf Writers Conference in 2013. He is also a widely sought speaker on topics ranging from the contemporary Latino experience in America to the consequences and processes of writing memoirs. He lives in Seattle, Washington, and of course, we are very delighted and honored to have Domingo with us here to join us to talk about his memoir and his writing. As you mentioned earlier, this book is the consequences of what happened in the first book. And you start off right from page one. It's already
brutal.
Yes, yes. Yeah. You begin when you're recovering at home after an attempted suicide.
Correct. I suffered from a complete like nervous breakdown as a result of a lot of things. Among them, you know, I was drinking far too much. What had happened at that point was my ex-fiance had been in a car accident, and she was in a coma, and my life really started to unravel at that part. And I sought out help. I went to, you know, medical doctors, I went to psychiatrists, I went to, you know, talking therapists, and nothing seemed to help. And at that point, I had just really kind of come undone. And it was at the end of like the 5-day stretch of like not being able to sleep. And that's what really kind of got to me. And in the end, I just kind of like broke down one night and just, you know, called it quits. I thought I had, but it really wasn't. It was very much from the safety of like distance, I can say that it was just, you know, a really, really like a deep cry for help. That's what it was. And it got answered. I mean, and that's the beautiful thing about this book, is that it's harrowing. There's a lot of really grim stories, and you're reading it, and you're going through it, and it's like, you know, dear God, can these people go through anything, you know, even worse? And then by the time you get to the last 100 pages, it actually turns into a fairy tale where everybody gets exactly what they wanted out of their whole lives.
And right at the beginning, also, you talk about your brother who has been on the wagon, but then suddenly everything stops.
Yeah, I open the book with the story of like my younger brother going to the University of Texas at Austin, and like, you know, he was a great kid, and he was like, you know, shining example, you know, of you know, just what the, you know, what the Martinez family can do. And he was like, you know, valedictorian of his high school in Corpus Christi. He was on the, you know, the football team, and he was, you know, weightlifting, and he was this and he was that. And he gets to college, and he just completely breaks apart. You know, he loses his scholarships. We don't hear from him for weeks. He's drinking. He's doing drugs. He just broke our hearts. You know, he just kind of disappeared into that miasma. And I start with that story because that was like sort of the that was the transition point where we realized that, you know, crud, as a family, you know, we are susceptible to all these things that we've ever, you know, heard about, you know, addiction and, you know, death, because he drank so much that, this is the opening story, is like he drinks so much that he blacks out while he's standing up, and he crushes the back of his head on a sidewalk, and, you know, he gets sent to a hospital, and, you know, and it's a head injury, coma, etc. And that's the thing. I mean, that was my vehicle into like opening the transition into like this next the middle chapter, the middle part, which is, you know, with my then fiance, which it's not a good way to transition into a relationship, as if you're bonding over like head injuries and comas, you know. It's pretty much prescribing, you know, catastrophe at the end there. And that's kind of what happened. But at the time, I was like so lonely and deluded that, you know, it just, I don't know, it felt that level of alarm felt like home at the time, you know, and it felt comfortable. And I was like, no, this is the relationship I want, I kept telling myself. And of course, all evidence pointed, you know, to the contrary. And, you know, that's the rest of the book. And, you know, as I was writing this, it's like, wow, you know, this is actually kind of a weird, harrowing fairy tale, because at the very end, everybody gets exactly what they wanted.
And what's great about it is that it's not fiction. It's not a novel. It actually happened.
No, right, right. I credit Dave Eggers, too, you know, for that reinvention of nonfiction. You know, prior to his book back in, oh, God, what was it? What year was it? Like 2002 or something. What was it called? Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. When he launched that book, it was, you know, a wonder kind. Everyone jumped on it, and it's like, wow, you know, this is, his writing that book was like Truman Capote writing, you know, In Cold Blood. Just completely opened a completely different, you know, he took an old genre and just kind of redefined it. And it's exactly what Eggers did with his book, except when I read it, I was like, huh, you think you got stories, buddy? Let me tell you about mine, right? and that's precisely sort of the spillover effect here, is like, the like Boy Kings is as truthful and honest as I could get it, due to like memories and, you know, corresponding memories with like my family, my brother Dan especially. This one I was a little bit more careful with. I changed names. I guarded people. I guarded my ex-fiance's family a lot more because, you know, they're pretty uptight. I took all the lessons that I learned from Boy Kings of Texas and, like, really guarded and protected myself this time.
We're visiting with Domingo Martinez. Domingo is the New York Times bestselling author of The Boy Kings of Texas, and a recent one is My Heart is a Drunken Compass, a memoir. When you're talking about your little brother and everything that happened, do you think, Domingo, that perhaps after he went to college, he was like, okay, the pressure's off, or he was so wound so tightly that everybody was watching him and he had to be good, he had to do this, and so all of a sudden he's on his own, and perhaps, I don't know what happened, maybe he just had a nervous breakdown or got tired, or
You hit it precisely on the nail. Speaking to him later, years and years later, after, you know, he came up and lived here in Seattle for about 9 months last year, and we had a chance to really, really sort of like talk to each other like we never had before. And precisely what you said was that the thing was that the Derek was he was born 14 years after I was, and so he was the oops baby, and so my whole family was in some aspect or another in a position of authority over him. So he had like 8 parents. And so everybody demanded something from him. And so that just really spun him, really wound him up. And that was the thing, was that he was such a likable kid. You know, he was the baby of the family, and everybody loved him. And he was this really, really cute kid. I say that pretty objectively. I got the pictures to prove it. And so he had all that attention. He was completely surrounded by attention. And so we got to see, and, you know, which is completely ironic, because as we were growing up, you know, none of us had anywhere near the amount of attention that Derek had. And so, and look what happened to us, right? But then him, you know, he gets the different treatment, and look at what happened to him, you know? And so it's kind of a cautionary tale in its own way. But yeah, he did explain that it's like he was so, he felt like he, you know, completely under the microscope growing up by everybody, that when he was finally able to make his own decisions and choices, it was all the really, really bad, wrong ones. Because he never got to explore that part of himself.
We're visiting with Domingo Martinez. Domingo is the award-winning author of The Boy Kings of Texas and also the recent book, My Heart is a Drunken Compass, a memoir. In the book, at the beginning, you also talk about fiancé or ex-fiancé who is in the hospital, but you get that phone call from her brother, and you have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, it's from her dad.
Her dad, I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. We had separated, and I had moved out, and this was like within like a month of us making the decision to call the marriage off. And so I didn't know in what standing I was with her family. I hadn't even broken the news to my family yet. You know, that she was 40, I was 39. And I joke about this in the book that, you know, it's one thing to be divorced at 40. It's another thing never to have been married by 40. And so we were both kind of like rushing towards that goal of 40, because people look at you funny. It's like, oh, there's something wrong with you, isn't there? And so we were like rushing to get married. So when we, you know, when we split up, I was reluctant to bring that up with my family also. And so I didn't know what, you know, where it was with her dad, and who I, you know, really genuinely liked. We had a really good friendship. And so, you know, here it is. It's like 2:45 in the morning, and he's like, and my phone's ringing, and it's him. And he's like, what's going on? And I'm like, good morning, you know, because they lived on the East Coast. And I was like, good morning, how are you, type thing. And it's like, you know, she had just been in a car accident, and they had called her. So by that point, she had already, you know, the accident had already been, you know, like 4 hours old at this point. And, you know, those are, and I describe it. I had that phone call and the other phone call where I was, you know, alerted to the fact that my little brother was in the hospital, you know, undergoing brain surgery also, roughly about the same time. And, you know, those are the phone calls that change your life. There's passages like that that I talk about, those moments, the phone calls that it's like before that phone call and then your life after that phone call. And I'm sure, you know, everyone out there listening, you know, has had those moments also. And that's a very scary, scary time to go through.
You continue writing in the book, almost like if what's happening to you is almost like a family curse.
I'm a bit more realistic than that. I mean, for instance, while I was deep into the last stages of like stage two alcoholism, uh-huh, nearing stage three, definitely like within sights of stage three, I knew what was happening. There was that little homunculus, you know, that little voice in the back of my head that was like watching everything, but felt completely like incapable of stopping. It was like I was caught in a certain type of gravity. I mean, my sisters all do really well. My father stopped drinking. I saw it very much as, unlike my little brother, I saw it very much that period in my life as the consequences of the choices I had made, the decisions I had undertaken, and I think that's why I kind of like marched to it, like to an execution. You know, it's just like, well, I did this, so I may as well go through all the way, you know, I may as well, you know, take my medicine. And I kind of distinctly remember just sort of being swept along and thinking, yeah, you know, let's see where this ends, kind of thing. Because these were my choices. I wasn't going to blame anybody else. I wasn't going to say, you know, Dad did this, or Mom, you know, Mama didn't love me. You know, I wasn't going to do any of that. I was going like, no, you know, I'm the one that's buying the gin at the store. I'm the one that's, you know, taking a medically prescribed Xanax as the doctor said so, because I didn't abuse drugs. That was the really ironic thing also, was that, you know, I would go to a doctor and they would prescribe something. I'd say, I'm on this, and this. And they're like, okay, well, why don't you try this too? All right. And so that I was doing. There was very little abuse of chemicals. Like I said, the irony was that I was doing all that as prescribed, and it was just destroying my mind. I just have a really sensitive brain chemistry, I think.
Was it perhaps, because I know you mentioned that some of those medications you took with alcohol?
I'm certain, you know, they're, you know, 80% there also. But even the days I was free and clear from booze, you know, I just couldn't sleep. I had this really weird thing called like a hypnic jerk, where the minute I was just about to fall asleep, like my leg would kick out. And I did all the research, and I like tried to figure out, is it, you know, is it this drug, is it that drug, is it this? It was just my limbic system. I was so overwrought, and, you know, I had so much anxiety in my body that I just, you know, the exercise didn't help. Nothing helped. I mean, it was just a matter of, I just needed to go through it and process it. In the end, that's what happened.
We're speaking with Domingo Martinez. He is a national New York Times bestselling author, The Boy Kings of Texas, and the recent book, My Heart is a Drunken Compass, a memoir. Earlier today, we were discussing some of my colleagues here at the university, and we're talking about, you know, the fact that I was going to interview you, and somebody said, well, you know, there is a stereotype out there, and I agree, that all Hispanics abuse drugs or drink too much, and just like there's a stereotype of other minorities. And the fact that, you know, you were taking the medications, prescribed medications, a lot of people do that for the right reasons. But there's also the incidents, and I'm not saying your little brother did this or not, but there are a lot of young people out there who experiment with the prescription drugs. So what's dangerous is not the guy in the street corner, but Mom and Dad's medicine cabinet.
Correct. And by the way, oh yeah, it went way beyond experimenting. And it was lifestyle choice with him and his purposes. And he'll be the first one to tell you. But correct. Let's just say it doesn't. The market doesn't really have, as far as from what I know. But you know, but I'm a 42-year-old man in Seattle, so I really don't know what the kids are doing anymore. But from what I gathered from Derek's point of view, you know, that it wasn't restrictive to socioeconomic background, you know, a cultural identity, you know, race, anything. in his culture, and by that I mean like, you know, the university system, if he wanted drugs, they were there. That was kind of his problem. You know, I describe him often, and he agrees, as an affable nitwit. And because he's just really, like I said, he's a really likable guy. And so people like having him around. And so when they have drugs, he has drugs because they just want him to, you know, kind of like, hey, it wasn't like the white kids, the black kids, the, you know, the Hispanic kids. Everybody was doing drugs. Again, and this is only from a, you know, a secondary point of view because I didn't have that experience. This was, you know, this was what he was telling me. And as far as stereotypes go, I, you know, you could stretch that stereotype and say, you know, if the Irish drink too much, you know, I wouldn't even, it's not even like a fence or anything. It's just, you can apply any label to any stereotype. But having said that, you know, I freely admit to, you know, my lost years. So if that makes it sort of applicable to a stereotype, then, you know, by all means, go ahead and slap me with it.
We're visiting with Domingo Martinez. He is a New York Times bestselling author, Boy Kings of Texas, and My Heart is a Drunken Compass, a memoir. As you just said, go ahead, I did it, slap me, whatever. But was that something that you also struggled with or you still struggle with, perhaps with guilt? Because sometimes as an older brother or as the oldest in the family or a father, you struggle with that guilt and you're going, you know, they did it because of me or right. It was my father. I should have been here, et cetera.
Oh, yeah. No, there's like a good like 25 pages written on that very topic that both my older brother and myself wrestle with this idea when, you know, we're sitting by our youngest brother's bedside, or he is, I'm up here, long story, but Derek's in the hospital, you know, our youngest brother's in the hospital. You know, that's interesting. I haven't actually asked my sisters if they have carried that guilt over, but I know in particular, my older brother and myself just completely just sort of self-lacerated our souls going, you know, he did this because of me. I know I did much more, and in fact, I wrote about 25 pages of it in the book. There's litanies, and there's, you know, I kind of shift point of view on that particular passage also. But Dan is a much more realistic, and he's got a much stronger id than I do. So I'm not sure just how far he takes, you know, that self-laceration. I, on the other hand, just felt like it was that you know, Derek's choices and, you know, and his crushed skull was like, was so much a result of my, you know, my influence on him that it may as well have been me that poured the booze down his neck and then pushed him. You know, that's how bad I felt from the distance.
What about your mom and your dad, and particularly your dad? Because as fathers, we feel, you know, we're responsible for our children, and but then we don't realize that they make their own choices.
Right. That's the point of clarity that, you know, we all have to reach at some point or another. But at the time, oh, God, Dad was just, he was a wreck. And you also have to put into context that by this point, you know, he was like 12 years sober. And so, and he was one of those AAers who very early on, you know, proselytizing left and right. He's like, no, this is going to solve everything. You need to go to AA. And you know, of course, me and Dad are like, sure, Dad. It sounds a lot more, you know, now as a 42-year-old man and having been through what I've been through, you know, I've actually taken his advice, and I do pop into the meetings every once in a while. But ironically enough, every time I go to a meeting, I feel like I want to drink afterwards. But anyway, Dad totally took that on himself. He just looked so crushed. He just looked so broken down to actually visibly, you know, just to, right in front of him to see exactly, you know, this exhibit, this extension of his of his own, you know, addiction issues. But like I said, at the end of this book, everybody gets what they want. Dad, at like 20 years sober, you know, he completely he is sort of a dark horse character, resurfaces as our father, you know, as our dad, and he's like in everybody's life now. Again, like 22 years sober, something like that. And he's just so present in everyone's life, calm. It's like he finally achieved the laurels of being actually described as our dad. You know, it's the back then we were quite resentful. Because back then we treated him like as sort of a, you know, an unwanted brother. You know, mm-hmm. Get away. You know, now he's achieved this level of maturity and like I said, this peace. It was a lovely transition for him all the way through. And you know, now he's got a great relationship with Derek, great relationship with me, great relationship with my older brother, Dan. We have a father all of a sudden at the very end of all this. And no one was more surprised than him and the rest of us.
That is great to hear. Domingo, thank you very much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with Domingo Martinez. He is the New York Times bestselling author of The Boy Kings of Texas. And the novel we've been discussing is My Heart is a Drunken Compass, a Memoir. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Primetime Postscript. I'm Mike Cuthbert. Kudzu is a fast-growing vine that covers more than 7 million acres in the southern United States. It drives out native plants, and a team of scientists recently found that kudzu causes air pollution. Sandy Hausman reports on that problem and what might be done to solve it.
Kudzu can grow a foot a day, wrapping its tendrils around tree trunks and snaking into the canopy of forests, depriving them of sunlight, nutrients, and water. Lerdau has been measuring air samples from areas where kudzu grows and comparing them with nearby plots with no kudzu, and he says the U.S. could be in big trouble if we can't get a grip on this plant.
We modeled what air quality might be like in about 2050 with continued spread of kudzu, and we found in that case that kudzu was essentially roughly able to undo the effects of federal air quality legislation on automobiles.
But stopping kudzu is difficult. It usually grows back after being sprayed, cut, or burned. The best bet, say some, is goats. Jace Goodling is president of a Virginia company called Goat Busters. He rents herds of goats to devour kudzu and other unwanted weeds.
They'll eat just about anything. They love poison ivy. They love honeysuckle, poison oak, paradise trees, ailanthus. Kudzu. They like kudzu.
And if goats can't wipe out this plant that's taking over 125,000 additional acres each year, as far north as Maine and Ontario, Virginia chef Steve Friedman thinks hungry people can.
In terms of taste, it's said to be somewhat reminiscent of the hardy greens, though perhaps a little sweeter. Things like mustard greens and collard greens.
Very
and so
flavorful
on.
Or?
Flavorful and earthy.
Friedman assembled a group of friends to show just how edible the plant that ate the South is. He invited each to begin the evening by tasting it raw.
Tastes like a leaf. It's
tasty.
Yeah.
Like a pea pod.
Yeah, like a pea pod.
Right.
Yeah. Actually, pea shoots is what it tastes like. It tastes like young pea shoots, a little bit.
But as they chewed the fuzzy young leaves, some took a strong dislike to the texture.
At first, it's sort of like a peach, but then as you chew it, you're left with this like hunk of fuzz.
Yeah,
so I can see why parboiling it is going to be a good idea.
Boiling the leaves helped eliminate the fuzzy sensation, and a food processor completed the job as Friedman prepared the first course, a kudzu pesto of olive oil, garlic, sea salt, and freshly ground pepper.
That's very good.
Yeah.
It's got a kick to it. What's the kick?
The kudzu, no doubt.
Kudzu.
Or the garlic.
Garlic?
The garlic.
Oh, it's wicked garlicky. It's very good.
In retrospect, the plants are quite different. Kudzu's large leaves are bigger than those of ivy. It has a sweet smell and those distinctive fuzzy leaves. The stem looks like a green bean, while poison ivy's vine looks like wood. But if there's any doubt, consult an expert. For Primetime Radio, I'm Sandy Hausman.
This has been Primetime Postscript, made possible by AARP and today, Sandy Hausman. See pictures and hear more postscripts on our website, aarp.org/radio.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTB Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sanz.